Who is going to get funding in this country? What programs are going to be funded in this country? And remember, Musk isn't a disinterested party here. As we've talked about, he has many federal contracts himself, billions of dollars this year alone to his companies, SpaceX, Tesla, and X, formerly known as Twitter. But he also is interested in cutting this funding for a very personal reason, which is he is interested in paying for the tax cuts that Congress is teeing up this year. They are estimating $5 trillion in tax cuts, mostly going to the wealthy and corporations. And Doge is the entity that is supposedly going to find the money, find the savings to pay for those tax cuts. So I think we can sum it up this way. Elon Musk is going to pay for his tax cut with your Social Security. That's really what we're looking at here. That's what Doge is up to.
And Lindsay Owens, we're going to have to leave it there. And I just want to give Waleed the last word. 10 seconds. What should people do right now?
People should go to indivisible.org and visit their Senate office and demand an investigation of Elon Musk, and that Senate business should come to a halt.
We want to thank Waleed Shaheed, Democratic strategist. We'll link to his piece, Elon Musk is Staging a Coup. And Lindsay Owens, thanks for joining us from Groundwork Collaborative. In your piece, there are several reasons Musk wants to control Treasury payments. None of them are good, she writes. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Earth Angel, will you be mine?
Hey, KBOO listeners. Join us at the station on February 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. for Stupid KBOOPID, First Friday Arts Walk. Enjoy art, listen to music, savor drinks, get your face painted, and pick up a Valentine's Day gift from one of our amazing vendors. There's something for everyone. We can't wait to see you. Wink, wink.
Earth Angel, the one I adore.
KBOO.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland approves a new land use permit for the controversial oil bio-rail company, Zenith Energy.
Striking Providence nurses at one clinic reach a tentative agreement.
And the Oregon Zoo welcomes a new baby elephant.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 3rd, 2025. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Portland approves a new land use permit for the controversial oil by rail company Zenith Energy. Zenith needed a new land use compatibility statement, or LUX, from the city after Department of Environmental Quality discovered the company had been constructing and operating pipelines in Northwest Portland without a permit. This move comes despite significant community pushback and a resolution put forth by two city councilors to stop the permit and investigate the company. It was filed by Councilors Mitch Green and Angelita Murillo on Friday. Green told the Oregonian, quote, "I'm disappointed to learn that the city has proceeded in issuing a lux while we have this resolution in process to address substantive questions around whether Zenith or city staff have violated the public trust," end quote. Community advocates have led the outcry against Zenith, pointing to their record of breaking the law and the danger that operations pose to Portland. Zenith operates in a CIE hub, a tank farm in northwest Portland, and runs oil trains through much of the east side. In the event of a train derailment or significant earthquake, the fuels could explode and create an environmental disaster. Portland has said no to Zenith once before, but since then, the company has said it will attempt to include some renewable fuels in its operation in Portland. City Council has tried to intervene in the process, but city staff has maintained that it has an administrative process that the elected representatives don't get to have a part in. Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden was on KBOO's Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein this morning and broke the news.
I mean, breaking news here on KBOO, the city actually did just approve a land use compatibility statement just right about now. And so that is something that flies in the face of, you know, that is a violation of the public trust. The public has been in good faith saying, here's what we really want to happen. You've seen the hundreds of people who have shown up to this. You've seen the promises that have been made. The city administrator's office, Donnie Oliveira in particular, interim deputy city administrator, continues to say that this is just simply a routine administrative matter. That has been false from, you know, for some years since they got their land use statement.
Why is that false?
Well, because Oliveira himself told the city auditor during an investigation into Zenith's illegal lobbying that it was not a standard process. Additionally, the city was winning in court in 2021, saying that Zenith's operations did not fit the city's comprehensive plan. The city had a lot of work to do. They had to reach out to tribes. That was one of the reasons they had declined the previous land use application to Zenith. Zenith then went and promised, okay, hey, we're just going to transition to renewable fuels. We don't know what it means. We don't know if it's possible. We don't know if it's better, whatever. But if it tells the city whatever the city wants to hear for us to have a land use statement, great, we'll say that. They have been working to transition to that. Again, these questions are still out there of whether or not it's better.
But the other side of it is they're still shipping a lot of fossil fuel, including this illegal addition they made to their facilities,
right?
Shipping through a dock at McCall Oil, which is across Front Avenue from them,
right?
And that would be new infrastructure under the city's ban on any future fossil fuel infrastructure, and it's just for fossil fuel. They're not shipping renewable diesel,
right? Yeah, and that's the question. I mean, one of the carve outs here is that if renewable diesel isn't available, they can just keep shipping fossil fuels. That's explicit. So there's actually nothing really holding them to this, and the city doesn't even seem to have the will to stop them from shipping fossil fuels. The sort of central point here, I think, when it went to the Land Use Board of Appeals, the Land Use Board of Appeals said this is a quasi-judicial decision. And that's important because what that means is that it would have a public process. Literally, the land use statement should have a public process according to the Land Use Board of Appeals. That's important. That's something that the city continues to ignore at every intersection. You know, any question that's asked of them, they ignore the fact that you know, court essentially said this should be a public process to the approval of any land use statement.
So would the city say, well, on January 21st, we did it, and we had that public input?
Yeah, I mean, it was a work session with council. I don't think that that's exactly what that is, but that is what this resolution that the two councilors proposed and submitted on Friday. So, you know, this is another piece of it that clearly is kind of going outside of the normal process, is that if you have a resolution that has been introduced by two city councilors calling for investigation with multiple appendices, you know, talking about the violations over the years, the backroom kind of process that Street Roots has uncovered, to go ahead and approve it, you know, which we're just finding out here now, you know, really flies in the face of the public trust. That's a real violation of public trust. So I think that the city's at a real point here where it needs to decide whether it's going to, the city council needs to decide if it's going to take power back from the administrative branch and if there's any kind of pressure that they can put on the city administrator. And then this the administrative side, the executive branch, needs to figure out who it is responsive to. Is it a fossil fuel company from Houston who's the only place they're experimenting with renewable diesel is right here in Portland? Or are they, you know, going to be responsive to the people who elected them?
That was Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Naden speaking with KBOO's Barbara Bernstein on an episode of Locus Focus this morning. Portland City Council will meet next Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. in the City Council chambers.
The record-breaking Providence nurses and doctors strike is still on, with thousands across the state still on the picket line. But at least one clinic has reached a tentative agreement with management. The 80 workers at Providence Women's Clinic would need to vote to approve the deal before they would go back to work. The tentative agreement establishes fundamental union protections and improves pay and working conditions. It's the first contract for the nurses and providers at the clinic. Oregon Nurses Association, the union for the nurses, says the nurses would get a 25-step wage scale depending on years of experience. Nurses would end up with a 4 to 20% pay increase right away. They would also get more funding for professional development and more significant pay increases at each level of advancement. The ratification vote closes tomorrow evening. Oregon Nurses Association and Providence are back in intensive mediation as of last week at the request of Governor Tina Kotek. Nurses and doctors at 8 Providence hospitals around the state are still on strike.
Oregon's long legislative session is in full swing, and lawmakers are considering hundreds of bills. One bill would ban any, quote, non-human entity, like artificial intelligence, from using the title of nurse. This comes after a tech company had announced to create the $9 an hour A1 program, AI program, that could be normally done by a nurse. Since nurses are real people, they make around $90 an hour. House Bill 2748 would ban the practice, and if passed, would be one of the first laws to regulate artificial intelligence in Oregon. That bill was introduced by Representative Travis Nelson from Portland, who is also a nurse. Supporters of AI in healthcare say that the tech helps with efficiency and increases revenues. Critics point out that AI is used by companies like UnitedHealth to deny patients the care they need. Other bill lawmakers are considering would ban betting on dog racing again. 3 years ago, a bill passed by Oregonians to ban Oregon-based gambling sites from accepting bets on dogs from any state where dog racing was illegal. But that left a loophole. Oregonians could still bet on greyhound racing in other countries or other states, like West Virginia, where it is legal. Oregon Racing Commission says Oregonians bet over $3 million on dog racing last year. House Bill 3020 would ban betting on dog racing and Oregon gambling sites, so no matter where the racing's happening. This bill is still in committee.
Washington County will open 2 emergency winter weather shelters starting Tuesday afternoon. That's when the weather is expected to dip to 25 degrees. People in the county seeking shelter tomorrow can go to the Beaverton Community Center at 12350 Southwest 5th Street. They can also go to the Blayton Street building at 20665 Southwest Blayton Street. No one will be turned away, including pets, and hot meals are provided. The shelters are open at 2 p.m.
Recent fires in Los Angeles are a grim reminder of the risks wildfires pose for rural and urban Oregonians. Fortunately, people have some simple, cheap, and effective ways to protect their homes and communities from wildfires. Isabel Charlet has more on this story.
As Los Angeles starts to recover, residents across the Pacific Northwest are being reminded of the risks that wildfires pose. Timothy Inglesby with Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology says firefighters are quickly overwhelmed by today's fast-moving wildfires. He says simple, proactive measures such as sweeping your roof of debris, keeping your gutters clean, and installing screens on roof vents are cheap and very effective ways of protecting homes. However, these efforts are not just up to individuals, says Inglesby, adding that we need to approach the problem as a community.
Because if you do all these things to protect your home, but your neighbor doesn't. It's your neighbor's house that will catch fire and then put yours at risk.
Inglesby urges people to keep lawns mowed and warns not to leave flammable objects close to the house. He says keeping up on these chores, as well as implementing more controlled burns outside of urban areas, will go a long way to protecting communities from wildfires. Once a fire starts moving house to house, Inglesby says it is almost impossible to control. He says people living rurally as well as in urban areas need to think about safety because embers from wildfires can travel for miles and ignite homes easily.
And if anything is teaching us a lesson now, in this era of climate change, we're all living in the fire zone.
Inglesby encourages everyone to think about their senior or disabled neighbors who may not be able to tend their own homes and give support as they can. He says everyone should feel empowered to help protect their communities. If we all do our part, Inglesby adds, wildland firefighters will not be needed to protect homes from wildfires because they won't ignite in the first place. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
President Trump imposes tariffs on Canada, but pauses plans to impose them on Mexico. Legal experts question Trump's use of executive orders, and mass deportations may start to take toll in the Southwest. More on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We have big deficits, as you know, with all three of them. And in one case, they're sending massive amounts of fentanyl, killing hundreds of thousands of people a year with the fentanyl. And in the other two cases, they're making it possible for this poison to get in.
President Donald Trump on imposing 25% tariffs on Mexican and Canadian imports and 10% tariffs on those from China. The White House says the levies on goods from the top three U.S. trading partners won't slow growth and will raise revenue, but according to a nonpartisan analysis, they would in fact cut economic output significantly and raise taxes by more than $1 trillion over a decade. The tariffs go into effect Tuesday and may be followed by further levies on steel and energy imports. The tariff on Canadian oil is only 10%, and economists say that and the 25% levy on Mexican crude have the potential to raise gas prices. Trump has signed a flurry of executive orders ending federal DEI programs and enabling mass migrant deportations. Tulane University law professor Stephen Griffin says he's rapidly accelerating a long-term trend towards a growth in presidential power with the help of Supreme Court rulings. Trump is setting a goal of cutting trillions from the budget in moves to strip civil service protections from federal employees, but Griffin says he sees another motive.
It's about influence and control, and President Trump pretty clearly wants to control in a very direct sense the entire executive branch of government, irrespective of laws passed by Congress.
The White House has offered all government employees a buyout with the hope they'll find private sector jobs, but the legal status of that is unclear. Congress would have to fund it, and the workers are barred from holding private sector jobs while still on the government payroll. Meanwhile, arrests are stoking fear among the families of the 75 million immigrants in the U.S., and economists say they could exacerbate issues like workforce shortages. In New Mexico, roughly 1 in 10 residents is a migrant. Industries including construction, food service, healthcare, and agriculture depend on their labor, and migrant-owned businesses add $12 billion to the state's economy. University of New Mexico political science professor Lauren Collingwood worries massive sweeps could also mistakenly target families who've been living in the Southwest all their lives.
In New Mexico, we have 3, 4, 5 generations, but look like they did yard work that day. An ICE official will be like, oh, they're an undocumented immigrant. Let's go detain them. And so that's one of the main challenges with these types of policies and laws.
Native American and Alaskan Native organizations are recommending their members carry their tribal ID in case they're picked up. Meanwhile, the Trump administration's goal of ending birthright citizenship is being met with backlash and legal challenges. More than 20 states and a number of local jurisdictions so far have filed suit to stop an administration executive order overturning the 14th Amendment right to citizenship for all born in the country. The blue state attorney generals say the federal government would do better to focus on the national lack of affordable housing, the price of health care, and reducing inflation. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with longtime labor and progressive strategist Jonathan Cecini on his opinion piece for the Portland Mercury, Homelessness is Economics. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, a Black History Month encore broadcast of It Did Happen Here. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 33 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a daytime high of 43. Today in history, in 2023, a freight train carrying hazardous materials derails and burns in East Palestine, Ohio, creating an environmental disaster. The quote of the day is from French philosopher Simone Weil, born this day in 1909. She wrote, quote, "The art of the symbol, art is the symbol of the two noblest human efforts, to construct and to refrain from destruction."
Tribal groups are writing to President Trump, asking him to respect and uphold tribal sovereignty. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. More than 20 tribal organizations are urging the Trump administration to respect tribal sovereignty and uphold treaty and trust responsibilities. The coalition sent a letter to President Donald Trump, the Interior Secretary, and members of Congress on Sunday. This follows actions by the administration in Trump's first 2 weeks in office, including a canceled memo which sought to freeze federal loans and grants. The letter states that recent orders are raising concerns among tribes and tribal organizations, including urban Indian organizations across the country, which provide healthcare, education, economic development, and other services to tribal communities. The organizations say questions remain about how federal agencies will interpret and implement the administration's executive orders and policies moving forward. The National Indian Health Board, the National Congress of American Indians, and the American Indian Higher Education Consortium are among the groups which sent the letter, emphasizing tribes are sovereign nations with unique political status and are not special interest groups. Tribal leaders across the country are seeking to build a relationship with Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum. He was confirmed by the U.S. Senate last week. The former governor of North Dakota received support from the five tribes in his state. According to North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hoeven, Burgum received support from more than 185 tribes. During his confirmation hearing in January, tribes were mentioned several times. He was questioned about tribal sovereignty and tribal consultation. Here's how Burgum described working with tribes.
Tribal consultation to me as governor of North Dakota has meant actually spending time and going to the tribes, listening, sometimes listening for hours to really understand what the issues are, and then in getting to people ahead of time, and then working on things that are important.
Burgum highlighted one area of concern in his state to improve public safety, saying he helped achieve agreements with tribes on law enforcement. Much of his hearing focused on energy development, but conservation and protection of sacred sites were touched on. Tribal leaders are hopeful he'll bring his work on government-to-government relationships and his knowledge of Indian country to his position as Interior Secretary, as he now oversees the agency in charge of Indian affairs and the management of public lands. Housing shortages and overcrowding affect most of Alaska, and the North Slope is no exception. In particular, the remote region faces additional logistical challenges, but also unique economic opportunities. That was the takeaway from a recent North Slope Borough Housing Summit held in Anchorage. The event highlighted affordable ways for residents to buy or build homes in the Arctic. Jack France is the director of the Borough Housing Department. He says that homes in the region are falling apart faster than new ones are being built.
You also hear about it when you have, you know, a young adult that wants to stay on the North Slope but has to move down to one of the lower cities just because of lack of housing on the North Slope as well.
France says that the country's most northern region, which is predominantly Alaska Native, is in a unique situation. The remote geography makes shipping and construction challenging and expensive, but he says residents of the oil-rich region also have interest and resources to purchase houses. He says that more than half of the North Slope homes are owned by residents. The Housing Summit aimed to connect potential home buyers to existing financial opportunities, available contractors, and affordable ways to ship supplies. For example, he says summit panelists discussed how residents and entities could form a co-op and order supplies together to cut shipping costs.
When you talk about economies of scale, generally, just more you order, the bigger discount you get.
The borough plans to put together a guide listing banks and contractors who are looking to work with buyers in the region. They also plan to present a report on the summit during Kivyuk, which is a midwinter festival being held this month. They'll also discuss it during future village visits. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Around the country, state legislatures are back in session in Colorado, The General Assembly is considering a bill to study universal Medicare for All coverage option. As Erica Lattis reports, this comes as Colorado residents continue to face rising health care insurance premiums.
As health insurance premiums keep rising, Colorado lawmakers are advancing a bill to look at a universal Medicare for All option. A 2020 report in the Annals of Internal Medicine finds administrative costs for private insurance and the time doctors spend on billing paperwork make up over one-third of all health care costs in the U.S. Nathan Wilkes is with Health Care for All Colorado. He believes the study called for in the bill will confirm previous research showing there's enough money to cover all Coloradans by removing the middleman.
All of those public costs that we're paying, a lot of which are going to insurance subsidies and things like that, are more than enough to cover a system where there's a single pipeline.
Insurance industry executives say they've worked to lower administrative costs, and some politicians have argued private companies have better incentives to be more efficient than government services. But administrative costs for private insurers in the U.S. are nearly six times the costs of Canada's single-payer system. Private insurers also argue they help keep overall costs down, in part by denying claims for procedures they see as unnecessary. Wilkes says because of the industry's lobbying influence, voters will need to convince lawmakers to ensure all Coloradans can access health care.
I think people recognize that there's a lot of profit extraction going on by companies that are not delivering any sort of health care services at all, while their family and friends are having to start GoFundMes to pay for their cancer.
According to the Colorado Health Institute, some 265,000 Coloradans had no health insurance last year. Wilkes points out Medicare's original aim was to eventually extend coverage to all Americans, not just seniors.
Truth is, a universal health care is as American as apple pie. Guaranteeing health care aligns with our nation's core values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everybody.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Employers around the country who work longer hours have boost productivity and putting their mental health and physical health at risk, according to a new report. The report says work burnout can create mental health issues and long-term physical ailments if some modifications are not made. Terry D. has more on the story.
New research is finding extra responsibilities at work can take a heavy toll. A report from Scripps Health shows a link between mental health disorders and work burnout. According to the report, emotional, physical, and mental exhaustion from continuous and excessive stress can lead to burnout. Left untreated, this can cause short-term sleeping difficulties and digestion problems. Resume Now career expert Keith Spencer says burnout is more than feeling overwhelmed, and he warns employees should heed the alert signs before their symptoms are unmanageable.
Burnout can also lead to and exacerbate issues like anxiety and depression. And in fact, signs of burnout often mirror other mental health symptoms like chronic fatigue, irritability, and detachment.
Over time, researchers say extreme overload can contribute to unhealthy relationships and lead to more serious health issues like heart disease and chronic muscle pain. Spencer advises coping mechanisms like setting work boundaries or finding mental health support. A 2019 study by JAMA Health found untreated mental illness cost nearly 430,000 Hoosiers more than $4 billion. Researchers say as stress levels build, many workers delay taking a break from an unhealthy work environment. Reasons can include unwillingness to leave tasks behind for a coworker or no money for a vacation. Spencer says if the environment is so toxic you think often of leaving, there are a few things to consider.
I do think it's important to kind of have that honest and ongoing discussion with yourself. Are there some boundaries that I can set at work that might alleviate some of these issues that I'm experiencing? It's really hard to say this is the moment when you should walk away or this is the moment where you should realize that nothing is getting better.
Spencer says striking a balance can help reduce stress or burnout if you cannot leave your job. He believes you can prevent burnout, but it will require some effort from you or the company. This is Terry D. for Indiana News Service.
A new baby elephant was born at the Oregon Zoo this weekend. Asian elephant Rose 2 gave birth on Saturday after 20 months of pregnancy. Zoo staff said the baby is around 200 pounds and is likely a girl. Steve Lefebvre with the Oregon Zoo called KOIN, "We couldn't be happier with everything. It's going so far. This is one of the smoothest births I've ever seen. Rose knew just what to do. She helped her baby right up. The kid was standing on her own within 15 minutes and took her first steps soon after that," end quote. This is Rose's third baby. Sue Stafford letting the mother and baby bond for the time being, so visitors won't yet get to see the young one. Asian elephants are endangered, with around 50,000 left in the wild.
Even drivers who don't switch to electric just yet can save on gas money and reduce pollution. Dr. Anthony Lizowith has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowith, and this is Climate Connections. Although a lot of people have made the switch to electric vehicles, many gas-powered cars are likely to remain on the road for a while. Some old cars still have many years of life left, and some drivers will still choose to buy gas-powered cars. But those drivers can still take steps to save fuel and reduce planet-warming carbon pollution. That starts with considering the fuel efficiency of the car you choose to drive. Generally, smaller and lighter cars tend to be more fuel efficient than bigger and heavier cars. And how you drive also makes a difference. For example, accelerating slowly from a stop can help save gas. And when driving on the highway, using cruise control can help you maintain a steady speed, which helps your car get better gas mileage. Cars tend to be most efficient below approximately 60 miles per hour, and they become less efficient as speed increases. So avoiding high speeds can also help save on gas. Finally, maintaining proper tire pressure and keeping the engine in good working condition can help a car run more efficiently. So with a few simple steps, even people who drive gas-powered cars can save money on fuel and limit some of their global warming pollution. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You've been tuned in to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 3rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we do encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer and engineer for tonight's broadcast is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatas, Terry D., Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Barbara Bernstein, and Dr. Anthony Lizowith. The director of the Evening News is also Althea Billings.